Welcome back to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, a Catholic book lover. And today we have with us Jim Papandrea. He's a teacher, author, speaker, and musician. After graduating from the University of Minnesota with a bachelor's degree in music and theater arts, Jim went on to receive his Master of Divinity degree from Fuller Theological Seminary with a concentration in youth ministry, then spent several years in full-time ministry. Jim went on to receive a PhD in the history and theology of the early Christian church from Northwestern University, with secondary concentrations in New Testament interpretation and the history of the Roman Empire. He's also studied Roman history at the American Academy in Rome, Italy. Jim's currently Associate Professor of Church History at Garrett Evangelical Seminary at Northwestern University, as well as a consultant in the area of adult faith formation and a regular speaker in parish and lay formation programs in the Chicago area. When he's not teaching or performing music, he's usually traveling, taking photographs, and making pilgrimages to places like Rome and Assisi. Today, Jim is with us to talk about his book from Sophia Institute Press titled From Star Wars to Superman, Christ Figures on Science Fiction and Superhero Films. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
And I got to tell you, Jim, before we get into the book, we're going to have a fun show here today. I saw this book when it was announced, and I totally geeked out. So maybe the answer to this is obvious, but what made you want to write this book?
Well, the seeds of this book were planted a long time ago. When I first started teaching, I was one of the early adopters in teaching courses on religion in film. And so I started, I created a class on religion in film, and I started teaching about religious elements and symbolism and imagery in films. And the films that seemed to be the most fun to teach and that most resonated with my students were the ones that had hero characters whose storyline paralleled the gospel or the life of Christ. And these are what we call Christ figures. They're savior figures who, perhaps go through some sort of incarnation, go through some version of voluntary sacrifice and then death and resurrection, either literally or metaphorically in the context of the film. And so, I've always wanted to write a book analyzing the Christ figures within science fiction and the superhero stories. And so I'm grateful to Sophia Institute Press for letting me finally do that.
Yeah, it's a great book too, Jim. So I want to dive in here and just lead off by talking about Star Wars, my absolute favorite movie series of all time. And I actually just saw Last Jedi this past week, and we're not going to spoil anything. So, but
I saw it Thursday night too. So,
so it seems glaringly obvious that in the original trilogy and up through the prequels and the, Rogue One, Force Awakens, and now The Last Jedi, that Lucas and everybody that picked up the mantle after him wove many themes of Christianity throughout his what's been referred to as a space cowboy trilogy. Isn't that correct?
Well, I mean, there are some parallels, and there certainly are things that people have been relating to sort of Judeo-Christian worldviews, et cetera, since, the beginning. And probably the biggest thing is the concept of the Force. Mm-hmm. And people have been trying to talk about whether or not the Force is some sort of deity, again, ever since the first movie came out in the 70s. I think that there are I think there are real problems trying to relate the Force to God in one way or the other, and certainly hope we can talk about that and get into it.
Yes.
But I think that the parallels to Christianity are not as strong as I think people want them to be.
Right. So let's talk about the Force. And in The Last Jedi, Luke had a very good definition of what it was when he was talking to Rey when he was going through her training. And you have a number of pages you dedicate to the Force in the section on Star Wars. So what can you share us a little bit more detail on what you just implied there about the Force maybe not being as Christian-based as we think?
Right. Well, first of all, I want to say that there's the latest movie, The Last Jedi, really just confirmed what I say about the Force in the book, and there's nothing that I saw that was new or different about
right.
the Force. I think some people wanted something new or were looking for some twist on it, but I really didn't think it was there. I mean, the Force is basically, as we hear in the very first film that came out, Episode 4, the Force is an energy that is supposedly permeating everything in the universe. But what we come to find out is that it's really a kind of dualistic version of a yin-yang with good and evil as sort of equal opposites. Mm-hmm. And what we find out is that the real goal of the Force in the Star Wars universe is not the triumph of good over evil, as we would expect it to be in a Judeo-Christian context. It's not the triumph of good over evil, but in fact, the balance of good and evil. There's actually a line in one of the in the animated Clone Wars series. There's a line where someone says, you know, if we don't have balance in the Force, the universe could be destroyed. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is a fate worse than death, right? That, mm-hmm. that there would not be balance in the Force. But, you know, early on we have this prediction that, you know, someone is going to come to bring balance in the Force. But at the beginning, the Jedi are strong, and as it turns out, who comes to bring balance to the Force but Anakin Skywalker, a.k.a. Darth Vader, brings balance by bringing in more evil. And that's how we first see balance in the Force. And the problem with that is that if the ultimate goal is balance, then evil has become a real thing that can be weighed against good, a created thing, and it becomes a necessary thing. Because if our goal is balance, then evil is necessary to balance out good. And once you make evil a necessary thing, you, philosophically, you've made it into a good thing. And at that point, the whole concept of good and evil loses all meaning.
That's a very good point. And as you go further in, you know, this entire section on Star Wars, and as the rest of the book's very eye-opening, I think. But you talk about in the Book of Revelation in the New Testament how the Roman Empire is depicted as oppressive, and you know, you have the talk about the unholy trinity, the false prophet, the beast, and the dragon, and you relate that back to Vader and the Emperor. Can you give us some detail on that?
That's right. In fact, I mean, you know, one of the things that first struck me in the Star Wars universe was that you know, George Lucas had clearly studied Roman history, because the history of the Empire is based on the history of the Roman Empire. First it was Republic, then one emperor gained power above all the other senators, and it became an empire. This is all based on the Roman Empire. Mm-hmm. And in the Book of Revelation, what we have is John writing to us, writing to people who lived under persecution in an evil empire, in the Roman Empire. And so in the Book of Revelation, we have this unholy trinity with the dragon, who is Satan, the beast, who is the Roman emperors who are persecuting the church, the imperial office, and then the false prophet, who is in other contexts referred to as the Antichrist, although the word Antichrist doesn't really come up in the Book of Revelation. But what we see in the Star Wars universe is we have that same unholy trinity, because instead of the dragon or Satan, you have the dark side of the Force, which is a real entity, and it's seductive. Instead of the beast or the emperors of Rome, you have the emperors of the Galactic Empire, starting with Emperor Palpatine. And then in the most recent movie, there is a parallel character, Snoke, I think mm-hmm. the name is. I wasn't clear on that. And then your false prophet or your Antichrist in the Star Wars universe is, of course, Darth Vader and the Sith who follow him. But we have that same sort of cast of characters repeated not only in the original, the first movies that came out, episodes 4, 5, and 6, but in the most recent movies, again, that same cast of characters and the same kind of storyline is repeated.
Definitely. And another thing I think needs to be brought up while we're on the subject of Star Wars is this constant struggle between light side and dark side. The pendulum's constantly swinging back and forth many times in what are now 9 films, with the latest being released, The Last Jedi. And I think that many people, this is what they find appealing about the Star Wars films.
You mean the interplay or between good and evil,
yes.
Light and dark, is that what you're saying?
Right, correct.
Yeah.
And how?
Well, it is.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Well, I was just going to say it is. It makes for good drama. But again, I keep going back to this idea that, you know, behind all of that is the assumption that what's really best for the universe is not for good to triumph over evil, but for good and evil to continue eternally in this in this battle with the pendulum swinging back and forth. And again, that's very different from the Christian worldview, which says, again, you know, going back to the book of Revelation, at some point, good triumphs over evil. And in fact, evil is not really a thing that exists or that's created, but in fact, evil is simply the rejection of good. And at some point, the creation is redeemed and remade, and good triumphs over evil. And so that's the goal of, you know, God's universe. And it's very different from what you get in Star Wars. I mean, the thing about the Star Wars universe, which, as you said, is now 9 films, if at some point good wins out over evil finally and fully, then you can't make any more films because it's done.
Right.
And we see the same kind of thing happening in a lot of the superhero stories, because, you know, it comes from a comic book where, you know, the people who sell comic books want to make more comic books. And as powerful as someone like Superman is, he's almost omnipotent, yet if he finally defeats all evil in episode or in volume 23 or whatever, there is no volume 24,
mm-hmm.
right? And so evil is construed as something that ultimately cannot be defeated. It can only be held at bay.
Right. And, you know, in some sense, it's almost as if they ran that risk in Return of the Jedi when Darth Vader died, and before he died, it's quite obvious that he returns to the light side.
Right, right. But the interesting thing about that is that, you know, if we're talking about Christ figures and we're talking about salvation, when you analyze Darth Vader, there is no Christ figure who saves Darth Vader. Darth Vader saves himself,
mm-hmm.
because even though Luke is willing to sacrifice himself for Darth Vader, that's not what saves Darth Vader. What saves Darth Vader in the end and redeems him is his own choice to turn against the Emperor and to try and protect his son. And so at the end of the day, the Antichrist saves himself by making the right choice, which again is a very different take on how salvation works than something you'd find in a Christian context.
Definitely. So with that, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back to talk about more superheroes and move on to some other topics. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, the Catholic book blogger. Catholic solution to the healthcare problem is here. Paying too much for your healthcare costs? Solidarity HealthShare is a healthcare sharing ministry which provides an ethical way to fund healthcare costs while protecting and practicing our Catholic beliefs. Best yet, Solidarity HealthShare's members are exempt from the fines and penalties in the Affordable Care Act. For more info, call 844-313-4999. Again, that's 844-313-4999, or visit SolidarityHealthShare.org. That's SolidarityHealthShare.org. Star Wars to Superman, Christ figures in science fiction and superhero films. Jim, we spent the last segment talking about Star Wars. Now let's talk about the competition, Star Trek.
Okay.
Man-made competition. But, you know, it's interesting that in your book, many thought Gene Roddenberry to be an atheist, but he definitely has Christian themes sprinkled throughout the multiple series of Star Trek he was involved in, correct?
Well, he does. And, you know, I think that this is a case of writers and producers who know that Christian themes and imagery and symbolism resonate with their audience and will get an emotional reaction from their audience. So in some ways, they're kind of playing to their audience. Gene Roddenberry is a really interesting character, and you know, whether you can call him an atheist or not is kind of under debate. I talk about this somewhat mm-hmm. in the book, but the bottom line is that, you know, he believed that religion could be good for the unenlightened people who need it to sort of keep them in line. It's a version of the old, you know, religion is the opiate of the masses argument.
Mm-hmm.
And so to the extent that, you know, Jesus preaches things like the Sermon on the Mount and peacefulness and all of that, Roddenberry would think, yeah, that's all good. He didn't really think you need Jesus for that, but the message of Jesus, detached from the man Jesus, he thought was a good thing for people to hear and live by. And so he uses these themes, and he sort of plays to those sensibilities, but he himself did not really believe any of it.
Right. So I think in all of it, and you know, I grew up the Next Generation. The one character that jumps out at me from the Next Generation is the android Data. Can you tell us a bit about his struggles that he had?
Well, Data's an interesting character, and you know, because he's an android, but he's some sort of advanced android who acts more human than, you know, than you'd expect from a robot, right? And so his interaction with the other cast members is as an equal. And as one who can make his own decisions and has free will, et cetera. And a lot has been written about Data and other androids and to what extent they can be considered a people or a person or even human in that sense, although you kind of have to stretch the definition of human at mm-hmm. that point. But it's very interesting because, you know, the episode that I analyze the most in the book has Data at one point saying, you know, that he can't believe anything if he doesn't have empirical evidence. And then later in that same episode, when he talks about his own decision to consider himself a person, he says, you know, I had to believe that I was capable of being more than just an android, and so I took a leap of faith.
Mm-hmm.
So within the same episode, he says, you know, he can't believe anything without evidence, and then later in the episode he says, that his whole personhood is based on himself taking a leap of faith. And I think this is a very interesting thing. And I interviewed the author of that episode. The interview is in the book. And he never even noticed the contradiction. I pointed it out to him. And so, you know, basically, I think what's going on there is that even people who don't believe instinctively recognize that a person needs faith to be a person. That faith and spirituality are part of the essence of humanity, part of what we are as made in the image of God. And they instinctively know that, even though they will write stories that promote the assumption that religion and spirituality actually hold you back from evolving as a person.
Right. And you know, just that whole struggle in that episode, it was The Measure of a Man, for those interested. And just that whole struggle with Data and, you know, as his series developed, you see him become maybe perhaps more in touch with the humanity that he desired but didn't really have.
Right, right. I mean, at one point in the story, in his story arc, he has a girlfriend. And so that's a real interesting thing. And, I mean, spoiler alert, but that girlfriend dies at one point, mm-hmm. and then he has to deal with her death. And it's very well done. I mean, I've always been a fan of Star Trek, and even though I, you know, take issue with the assumptions on which the Star Trek universe is based, I think it's very well done, and a lot of the writing is brilliant. And so, it's definitely worth watching. It's enjoyable, and it's great material for discussion, like we're having. You know,
in one episode, I had totally forgotten about this episode until I read your book, and that was Rightful Heir, where Worf had dealing with the godlike, Christ-like figure, or godlike figure, Kalis, the Klingon Messiah. Can you
right.
tell us a bit about that?
Well, so Kalis is the Klingon Messiah, and when you watch this episode, it becomes very clear right away that, you know, the character of Caylus is a ripoff of Jesus, right? He's this guy who lived thousands of years earlier, who, you know, united the people and rallied them around a kind of, you know, moral code. I mean, it's a Klingon moral code, so it's not the Sermon on the Mount, but, and then he goes away, and it wasn't clear whether he dies or what, but he goes away and he promises to return. So this whole idea that there's a promised return, right, parallels the promised second coming of Christ. The problem is that when we finally meet Caylus and he does return, and I won't spoil it for anyone who wants to go out and watch the episode. It's on Netflix. But when we meet Caylus, what we find out is that he's not the kind of savior who will give his life to save other people. He's the kind of savior who just simply sets a good example. And if you want salvation, you have to follow his example. So in essence, you have to save yourself by following the Savior's example. This kind of savior, or this kind of salvation, is actually very much like one of the ancient heresies that the church fathers dealt with in the time of the early church. When the church fathers were teaching that Christ was divine and came down to be human, there were some who disagreed with that and proposed the idea that Christ was actually a mere human who started out as one of us but elevated himself to hero status through his own discipline and willpower. And then the way to salvation would be to follow his example and do that yourself. And so this what we call adoptionist or Arian version of Christ from the early church, you know, keeps popping up, and including places like Star Trek, where the Klingon savior figure is actually an Arian version of Christ.
Right. And one thing I want to get a little off course here a bit, but I think is definitely worth mentioning, is throughout this book, you've sprinkled these sections where you're pulling out these heresies. You have six of these sections in the book. Can you tell us a bit about, you know, why you planted them in there and how you're tying them into all these different movies?
Sure. Well, I mean, you know, this book is really about knowing what to look for when you go into watching these kinds of shows and movies. I'm not just pointing out where we can see, you know, elements of the gospel, but I'm analyzing and comparing the Christ figures to the real Christ, and I'm critiquing them where they fall short. And so, so one of the most prominent things about the real Christ, one of the most important things that we know about the real Christ, is that he has two natures, a divine nature and a human nature. So we say he's fully divine and fully human, right?
Right.
Well, when we look at these Christ figures in popular culture, some of them have a parallel to the human nature. They're human, they're one of us, but they don't have a parallel to the divine nature. Others have a parallel to the divine nature. They're superhuman. They're aliens, or they come down to Earth, or some way that sort of parallels or is a metaphor for divinity. But maybe they don't have as much of a parallel to the human nature. If they're you know, a phantom and not even tangible or something like that. So what we're looking for as we compare these things to the real Christ is, among other things, you know, do they have some parallel to the two natures? Because if they don't have a divine nature, if they don't have some kind of metaphor for divinity, then their salvation can't be a version of divine intervention. And if there's no divine intervention, that sort of implies that we can save ourselves, that humanity can save itself. And as Christians, we don't believe that. And so these are the kinds of things I'm pointing out. And there are various heresies from the early church that I compare to the different Christ figures in the stories. But for the most part, they fall into categories like the ones that have humanity but no divinity, the ones that have divinity but no humanity, etc.
Right. And in the back, very back of the book, a really cool feature I thought you have in here is this orthodoxy score chart, and which I might add, Caylus scored the lowest.
That's right. He did.
How did you come up with this scoring method?
Right. Well, you know, like I said, you know, one of the criteria for comparing a Christ figure to the real Christ is the idea of the two natures. But there are other criteria as well, and they all are found in the Nicene Creed, because the Nicene Creed is the church's sort of clarification of who Christ is. And so I use the elements of the Nicene Creed as my criteria for the orthodoxy score. So if I'm talking about a particular Christ figure or hero character, does this hero character have some parallel to a divine nature? Does this Christ figure descend, come down to humanity to become one of us? Or does this Christ figure start out as one of us and elevate himself? That, you know, that would not be like the real Christ. Mm-hmm. You know, does the Christ figure voluntarily sacrifice his life? Is there some parallel to a death and resurrection? So I put all of these together as criteria and gave them all a possible 5 points each. And so so basically then the characters, each of the characters in all of the stories that I analyze is given an orthodoxy score. The higher the score, the closer they are to being a parallel to the orthodox Christ, the real Christ, as opposed to some false version of Christ.
Mm. Definitely a very interesting part of the book. But we're going to take another quick break, and you've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media, and we'll be right back. Let bad coffee leave you bitter. Experience the pure taste of artisan small batch coffee with Grim Bean Coffee Company. Grim Bean's whole bean and ground coffee is sourced from 90 farms across the coffee belt from organic, fair trade, and direct trade farmers. With over 20 coffee selections, Grim Bean is sure to match your taste. Single purchase and subscription services delivered to you ensure that you will never be without your favorite coffee again. Visit GrimBeanCoffee.com today for 10% off your order with the code BREADBOX at checkout. Experience the best with Grim Bean Coffee Company. Press, Star Wars to Superman, Christ Figures in Science Fiction and Superhero Films. Thus far, we've covered Star Wars and Star Trek. Now I want to hit a couple other ones that actually I was surprised to see in the book as I was going through it. And the first one being the Terminator. I've always looked at the Terminator as just this really good dude movie where people are fighting. But you bring out the fact that there's a number of characters in the film that have Christ-like attributes, and I like to quote a section of the book, which I thought really drew it out. And this is the quote. In time travel stories in which there is a Christ figure, often the time travel itself represents the incarnation as the Christ figure travels back in time to bring salvation to the inhabitants of the world in the past. That's just to set it up. But to go back to the previous paragraph, I thought there are three savior characters in the Terminator films, and all of them at one time or another say a version of the line, "Come with me if you want to live." Several commentators have pointed out that John Connor's initials are JC, as in Jesus Christ, but John Connor's not really the savior in the story itself, but rather in a backstory, and in fact, he first has to be saved in order to be the savior. Others noted that Sarah Connor is a kind of Mary figure, complete with a virgin birth, and that the father of her child is not from among people of her own time, but is from outside of her time and place, from the future. But although she may be called the mother of the future, Cal Reese is not Joseph. He is, in fact, the Christ figure of the first film. So there's a lot of stuff going on there, and, you know, I never picked up on that. So can you walk us through that a little bit?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you think about the incarnation, and this is so relevant right now as we are approaching Christmas here, but if you think about the incarnation, God descending to come into the human realm in order to be our Savior in the person of Jesus Christ. And in these time travel films, that happens through time travel. So in the first one, Kyle Reese descends into the world of the past to be the savior for Sarah Connor. And then in the second film, the Terminator himself, played, of course, by Arnold Schwarzenegger, becomes the Christ figure who descends into the past to be the savior of John Connor. And in both cases, they're also the savior of future humanity. And so they sort of drop in or descend. Again, like in the Nicene Creed, we say he came down. They come down from the future, and they are Christ figures in the sense that in both cases, they give their lives to save the people that they were intending to save. And, there's different forms of resurrection. You don't get a literal resurrection, but with Kyle Reese, he obviously becomes the father of John Connor. And so John Connor is almost the resurrected version of Kyle Reese. And then with the Terminator, we have different metaphors for resurrection as well, but we see these themes, Christian themes, repeated in these Christ figures in each case.
Yeah, definitely interesting stuff, and the story keeps going on like every other series we have nowadays. Another one that I personally like, some people don't like it, is the cult classic Planet of the Apes. Now, I grew up with, sorry, Jim, I watched the reruns. I finally remember watching the TV series, and we have the newer films out now. But after reading your book, I was, how does the Christ figure appear in a movie about, as Charlton Heston famously quoted, "Dirty Apes"?
It's a madhouse. I'm primarily, when I talk about Planet of the Apes, I'm primarily looking at the first of the original films, because there were five films.
Yes.
Originally. But after the first one, the others sort of each became a soapbox for the writer's political views. So I talk about the first one primarily, and then the remakes of the more recent films a little bit. But in the original one, Charlton Heston plays this character, Taylor. Mm-hmm. And again, it's kind of a time travel story because, of course, he doesn't know he's traveled into his own future at this point. But he literally drops in on a spaceship into a world where humans are enslaved. And he sort of becomes a savior figure for those humans. Now, granted, it's the salvation is incomplete in this movie. It doesn't really work out that well, because at the end of the movie, the humans are still enslaved and not that much changes. But the idea would be that he was going to come and bring enlightenment and bring the knowledge that humans had actually evolved first before the apes, and that's the knowledge that the leaders of the ape culture were trying to suppress and keep from being found out. And he almost succeeded in making it known, but in the end they prevented him, and all he could do was take the girlfriend, the one woman that he had met, and ride off into the sunset. So he saves her, but he doesn't really save humanity. But that's kind of the idea, that he is a savior figure, because he drops in, he descends, he comes down, and he attempts to save the people who need liberation at that point.
And another key aspect of the film that you bring up is the whole story of evolution. You talk about the orangutan doctor who calls Cornelius and Zira perverted scientists who study a theory called evolution, which I think is a very interesting aspect of the film, because of the whole play on, Charlton Heston's character coming into this planet of evolved apes.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a lot of it is a dig at religious conservatives who were skeptical, and some who still are, of the theory of evolution. And so it kind of reverses that, and it it turns the apes into the religious fanatics who know the truth about evolution but are hiding it from their people in order to keep their position. The one orangutan character is both the head of the science and the head of religion. And so as the head of religion, he's suppressing science so that people don't know the truth. And again, this is kind of a dig at the church and at religious people, as though, faithful Christians are somehow, suppressing the realities of science or ignoring scientific research or things like that. And so it's a very anti-church message. It's part of that whole genre that I call, the church is hiding something from you. And you might not notice it when you just watch the movie and enjoy it. But right. There's definitely that message in the subtext there.
Yeah, well, I got to tell you, after reading your book, I'm going to be watching out for more of these things as we go through these different films. Now, one character that I have to admit, and if you ever meet my daughter, don't tell her I'm about to say this, I don't watch Doctor Who, but she does, and I know a lot of people do. And what I think, I'd like you to talk about Doctor Who, because he ranked the highest, the Doctor ranked the highest on your Orthodoxy score chart.
Yeah, right. And it's funny, when I started writing this book, I was really looking forward to writing the Doctor Who chapter, because I'm a big fan of Doctor Who. I have been since the 80s when I discovered Doctor Who. And I really expected, now for Doctor Who fans, that Doctor Who has two hearts, right?
Okay.
And I really expected to find out when I did my research that the original creators of the character Doctor Who back in the 1960s did that on purpose, as a way to parallel the two natures of Christ.
Mm.
The two hearts of Doctor Who would be like the humanity and divinity of Christ. As it turns out, when I did the research, I found out that is not the case. They did not write that to be an intentional parallel to Christ. In fact, there's some pretty mundane reasons for why they did it, and it turns out there are other species in the universe who have two hearts as well. Nevertheless, when I analyzed Doctor Who, for parallels to the Christ story, he does come out very high on the Orthodoxy score. And that is even in spite of the fact that, throughout the history of Doctor Who, he's had some of the most atheistic writers and producers, especially in the more recent, since the 2005, reboot of the series. But this is kind of my point of the book, that even people who aren't believers can't help but incorporate Christian themes. And I think there's two reasons for that. I think partly because they're doing it on purpose because they know that it will resonate with their audience. But I think also there's an unintentional or subconscious thing going on here, because I believe that since we're made in the image of God, we are hardwired in our psyche to be ready to receive the incarnation and to be ready to receive Christ in our lives and to be ready to accept the idea of a Savior who comes down into our world and sacrifices himself and dies and rises and saves us. And I believe that that's hardwired into us to be ready to accept that kind of idea. And that's why I think it keeps popping up in popular culture and in stories.
Awesome. That's a good way to close this segment out. We're going to take one more break. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Bedbox Media, and we'll be right back. Hi, I'm Pete Sox, the host of Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. Head on over to my show page at breadboxmedia.com and support my show and our work here at Breadbox Media by becoming a premium member today. And we believe it's more about giving than receiving. When you become a premium member for just $9.99 a month, you unlock incredible discounts from our sponsors like Rugged Rosaries, Catholic Books Direct, Lifeboat Coffee, the Mass Box, and the Harrisburg Senators, just to name a few. And it's even better. Every month, Breadbox Media chooses a nonprofit organization to partner with, and 10% of every premium membership is dedicated to that nonprofit. Join the revolution in Catholic media. Become a premium member by visiting my page today. Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, the Catholic blogger. We've been spending today with Jim Papandrea, and we're talking about his book, From Star Wars to Superman, Christ Figures in Science Fiction and Superhero Films. And Jim, we couldn't hardly have this conversation or have a complete book if we didn't talk about the Marvel and DC universes. So I'm going to put you on the spot. Marvel or DC?
Oh, boy, that's a tough one. I mean, I think... You know, as a kid, when I was into the comic books, I think I gravitated more toward Marvel. I think my favorites were Spider-Man and Iron Man. Those are both Marvel, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Spider-Man and mm-hmm. Iron Man. Now, as I'm an adult and as I have really begun to analyze the characters and their stories, I think now I gravitate more towards the ones who are maybe going to get a higher orthodoxy score, like
right.
Superman and Wonder Woman, for example. It's kind of hard to pick. I think as far as the films go, I like the Marvel films better than the DC films, but not by a lot.
Right. So let's talk about the Marvel Universe to start this segment off. And it's huge. 4 phases of films now, 20 movies plus in this all-encompassing series leading up to what Disney has promised to be a huge cataclysmic uproar in the Marvel Universe in Avengers Infinity War in 2018. It's going to be so big, it's going to be 2 movies to tell that story. There's plenty of opportunity within these 20 movies to weave Christ figures in. So can you share a few that you found particularly important in the Marvel Universe?
Well, sure. I mean, I think that, as I said, you know, a couple of my favorites when I was a kid, Spider-Man and Iron Man. I mean, these are definitely characters in which parallels to the gospel pop up. And sometimes it's so obvious that it's kind of ridiculous. I mean, I can think of a few times in Spider-Man movies where they put Spider-Man in a cruciform position with his arms stretched out at a crucial point in the storyline. And, you know, usually he's holding onto webs and he's trying to pull something together, whether it's a train or a boat or something. And it's like stretching him out. And he's willing to give his life at that point to save the people on that train or that boat or whatever it is. And so, you know, this is so obvious. It could not be more obvious that here he is in a cruciform position like Jesus on the cross,
mm-hmm.
Making this sacrifice, right?
Yeah, and he did that in Spider-Man Homecoming.
Right, exactly. And that wasn't the first time. Mm-hmm. So, and I think Iron Man as well, you know, we see some of that stuff. The thing about these characters, though, is that they are actually not very orthodox in terms of their parallels to the real Christ, because a character like Iron Man is really a mere human. His only superpower is maybe a super high IQ and a really big bank account, but he's really a mere human who elevates himself to hero status through his own, you know, discipline and through his own work and striving. So again, like Batman, he is a kind of adoptionist or Aryan Christ figure. He doesn't descend. He doesn't start out above us and come down to us, but he starts out as one of us and elevates himself. I think Spider-Man is kind of the same way. Spider-Man has the added element of, you know, the radioactive spider bite. So he didn't do it himself.
Mm-hmm.
There's this little bit of a mystical element there. But still, he starts out as a mere human and is elevated to hero status. And so, you know, we gravitate toward these superheroes like this, I think, because they're the kind of superhero that give the impression, you know, this could be me. I could be a superhero. Like, if a radioactive spider bit me, I could be Spider-Man. And so they are like human potential personified, and they allow us to fantasize that we could be superheroes. I mean, none of us can fantasize that we're Superman because we weren't born on Krypton, you know? So within the Marvel universe, I think, you know, some of the most popular superheroes are the more Aryan or adoptionist versions of Christ figures. Whereas in the DC universe, some of the most popular ones are more orthodox. Now, Batman is not orthodox. Batman's another Aryan Christ figure. But when you get to Superman and Wonder Woman, now we're talking about characters who descend, who start out greater than, I mean, Superman's an alien, comes down to Earth. He literally descends. Wonder Woman has some sort of, you know, divine element to her, depending on which origin story you accept. But they have this divine element to begin with, and then they sort of become one of us by blending in with humanity. And so arguably that, you know, gives you the two natures parallel. And so, it's hard to talk about DC versus Marvel. It's more like I'm talking about, you know, what end of the spectrum are these superheroes on? Are they on the end of the spectrum where they have all the humanity but none of the divinity, like Batman, Iron Man? Or are they on the other end of the spectrum where they have all the divinity but maybe not humanity, like the Silver Surfer or some of these other characters that are so alien that they're not even tangible?
Yeah.
Or are they closer to the middle where the real Jesus is, having the two natures? Like I think Superman and Wonder Woman, they get the highest orthodoxy scores of all the superheroes because they are closest to that, having those two natures.
Right, and I think it's rather interesting, the line in Justice League, and you alluded to it a little bit in your Iron Man discussion there, when Barry Allen's looking at Bruce Wayne saying, "So what's your superhero power?" And Bruce Wayne replies, "I'm rich."
Yeah, right, exactly.
So speaking of DC, I think when I really started taking note of Hollywood interjecting some of this Christ-like figures into film in this huge glut of superhero movies we've seen in the last 10 years, that was in Superman Returns. And when he looks at Lois and he said, quote, "You said the world doesn't need a savior, but every day I hear people crying for one," end quote. That was a pretty blunt line.
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, I mean, in one of the more recent ones, I forget which one, but there's a point where, you know, Superman is agonizing over a decision that he has to make, and in the background you see a stained glass window with a picture of Jesus praying in the Garden of Gethsemane.
Yes.
So, you know, again, could they be more obvious? But the interesting thing about Superman is, of course, that he didn't start out as a Christ figure. He started out as a Moses figure. And if you look at the comic books, which, of course, were written by a couple of Jewish guys, in the comic, he is, you know, this baby who's put in a space basket and floated down the river of space, just like Moses, right? In the original comic, his parents didn't intend to send him to Earth to be a savior. They just were hoping he'd land on some planet with air to breathe.
Right.
But then when it was made in, when they started making the films, especially with, I think, the Christopher Reeve films, then he becomes this savior figure who is sent to Earth on purpose because the Earth people need him. And we get these, you know, this dialogue from his father who's saying, you know, "You are my only son, and I'm sending my only son." And all this language, like it's almost right out of the Book of John in the New Testament. And so he really becomes a Christ figure in the films, which is why I focus more on the films in the book than the comics, you know.
And you know, again, continuing with Superman Returns, the Brandon Routh one, you know, there's the scene where he's just getting beat terribly by Luther, which it draws a parallel to the Passion of Christ. He's just getting totally pummeled by Luther and his thugs. He gets stabbed in the side with a shard of kryptonite, much like Christ did with the spear. But then, you know, fast forward into Batman, Superman, Dawn of Justice, they continue this motif that after Superman's killed by Doomsday, what seems to unfold in front of everybody is this remake of the Pieta scene with Batman luring Superman from his, quote, cross into the arms of Wonder Woman, who could conceivably be the Mary figure in that scene. So it seems Hollywood is by no means shying away from any of this.
That's right. They're, but I think that, you know, they're not trying to promote the gospel. They are appropriating our imagery for the emotional impact it'll have on the audience. And you know, when you see the other imagery that they use, you know, it's not just Christian imagery. They're perfectly happy to use Norse mythology, Greco-Roman mythology. And so many of these writers, they see Christian imagery as one group of symbols among many to choose from in their, you know, in their toolbox of, you know, how to grab the audience. But yeah, it's certainly getting more and more obvious, I think.
Right. And I think Wonder Woman, the Wonder Woman film did a good job of pulling that out as well.
Right. And, you know, I mean, again, there's nothing wrong with us as Christians enjoying these shows.
Right.
But we do need to go into it with our eyes open so that we don't let the fact that there are parallels to the Christ story sort of blind us to the fact that there are also negative assumptions and negative messages and even anti-Christian messages in the subtext very often in these stories as well.
Yes, that's a very, very good point. And, you know, as we wrap up here, I want to first, I want to give you an opportunity to tell people where to find your work, and particularly Star Wars to Superman.
Yeah, well, this is this book is from Sophia Institute Press. They're just a great publisher to work with. And the best thing to do is just go right to their website, which is sophiainstitute.com. But all of my books can be found on Amazon. And if people go to drjimsbooks.com, that'll take you right to my Amazon author page. It's drjimsbooks.com.
And I want to give you an opportunity to close with any closing thoughts you have on what we discussed today.
Well, you know, I would want to say that this book, From Star Wars to Superman, is not written for theologians. It's written for people who love sci-fi and superheroes, but who also want to look deeper and go deeper in some of the conversations about the symbolism here. So any Trekkie, Whovian, or Jedi who wants to, get into some theology, this book is for you.
Awesome. Jim, I want to thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you. It's been great.
Awesome. And that's all we have for this episode. You've been listening to Off the Shelf. Here on Breadbox Media, I'm your host, Pete Sox, the book blogger. And until next time,